You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of May, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Phil Horn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with Oscar Guardiola Rivera, who joins us now in the studio. Oscar, what do you have for us today?
The agenda for today is history repeating. Is Venezuela 2013 the next Chile 1973? Is Syria going the way of Iraq? We'll have it all.
Oscar, thank you very much indeed. How free is the press to report where you are? We'll be taking a trip around the globe from Latin America to Africa via the Middle East to discuss the state of press freedom.
Government corruption is freely reported on. The powerful military establishment remains largely untouched. Journalists know which areas they can push and which they can't.
That was Samira Shakil in Pakistan. Also coming up, we reminisce over the history of the people's car, the Volkswagen Beetle, and we'll run through this morning's front pages from Turkey.
All that plus will be in Jakarta, and there'll be music, I promise. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House with Steve Bloomfield and Phil Hahn. But before all of that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news headlines for around the world.
Monocle 24 News. The United States could change its policy on arming rebel fighters in Syria. Last year, President Obama rejected a proposal to supply weapons to the groups opposing President Assad, but has now said all options are under review. The UK says it's also considering arming rebels. An EU ban on providing weapons runs out in a few weeks. In Syria, one rebel group claims it seized an unexploded chemical weapon. Commander Louis al-Mekdad accuses pro-Assad forces of using toxic agents.
We have a lot of evidence, we have blood sample, we have the people who affected by this, and we have samples from the ground. And the new things that 4 days ago in Saraqib, we have some bombs that not explode. We have this chemical weapon not explode, and we put it in container, and we can provide it for any country.
The special prosecutor in the killing of former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto has been shot and killed in Islamabad. Chaudhry Zulfikar Ali was ambushed as he left his home to travel to a court in the city. The attack comes less than 2 weeks before Pakistan's elections. Mr. Ali was leading investigations into the assassination of Ms. Bhutto in 2007. An Indian man who was killed in a Pakistani prison after being convicted of spying is to be buried today. Large crowds are expected at the funeral of Sarabjit Singh near to the city of Amritsar. He was sentenced to death by Pakistan more than 20 years ago, but died after being attacked with bricks at a jail in Lahore. Sukhbir Singh Badal is the Deputy Chief Minister of India's Punjab state.
Very sad. Pakistan has shown their true colours. They've shown that they don't have a human face. And we should take up this matter in the international forum. How they are treating our prisoners.
Officials in Bangladesh now say that more than 500 people died in the collapse of a factory building near to the capital, Dhaka. More bodies were pulled from the rubble overnight, and a large number of people are still missing. 9 people were arrested over the collapse of the building, which housed 5 clothing factories. Today is Press Freedom Day, an event set up to highlight challenges to the free flow of information. It's 20 years since it was set up, but organisers say in dozens of countries, journalists still struggle with censorship, detention and even violence. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says it's intolerable.
Many languish for years in brutal conditions as a result of sham trials or trumped-up charges. I condemn all such attacks and repression. I'm especially concerned that so many of the perpetrators escape any form of punishment.
In China, more than 900 people have been arrested for selling fake or dangerous meat. Officials say that in one case, foxes, mink and rats were passed off as mutton. They seized more than 20,000 tons of suspect meat. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Doesn't that just sound delicious?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure that would be my sort of preferred breakfast
meal. Rat, not really.
No, not my thing.
Thanks very much, Paul. Paul will be back in about 25 minutes with another check of the world headlines. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monaco 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monaco 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monaco 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. The time here is 5 minutes past 8 o'clock in the morning. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Steve Bloomfield. Well, let us start as ever with the agenda setter. And this morning, we're in the Americas, North and South. Oscar Guardiola Rivera is a senior lecturer at London's Birkbeck University and a regular Monocle 24 contributor. Oscar, in a moment, we'll talk about Venezuela and Mexico, but let's begin by looking at the choices the U.S. has to make over Syria.
Very difficult. It's a sort of no-win situation for everyone. It's becoming increasingly clear that the case for intervention is being made. Suspicions about the use of chemical weapons and so on and so forth. Today, the media is announcing that the Kremlin would accept the moral case for intervention. The problem is that the options are terrible. Those who supported intervention are now saying that it might be too late. So any help for the rebels is going to fall into the hands of al-Nusra and all sorts of unsavory characters. But it remains the case that the war is becoming more and more crude as days go by.
Talked before about history repeating itself, and obviously the shadow of Iraq looms rather large over Syria, but also the shadow of Afghanistan in the 1980s is here as well, isn't it, in terms of who America decided to back then and what they did with those weapons once they defeated the Russians.
Well, I wish William Dalrymple was here, because he, who is the expert on what happened in Afghanistan in the 19th century, has talked to us all that exactly the same happened the last time around, still happening. And it looks like things will go down the exact same way in Syria. So no good options there. It is calculated that the U.S. Would have to put some 160,000 troops in the ground in order to police a post-conflict situation. And no one is going to do that politically.
And that is something that Senator John McCain, the Republican, and he's a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He was asking for the Americans to prepare for sending troops on the ground. Doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon. I'm just wondering, how damaged is Obama's credibility on this matter? It seems like there's been a bit of flip-flopping from him on this issue.
Well, it is clear that he wanted to focus on internal affairs, and for good reason. I mean, look at what happened to Bush Jr. And also being dragged to this war would be complicated. The precedent seems to be Bosnia, and that was a very costful. So, in economic terms, in political terms, things are difficult.
Let's talk about Venezuela and your view that Venezuela 2013 is threatens to become like Chile 1973, which obviously was a socialist government that was ousted by a US-backed coup. You're not necessarily suggesting it's going to go exactly that way, though, are you?
Well, hopefully we won't have the Hawker Hunters bombing any presidential palace anytime soon. But the way things are going is exactly the same thing, the same way in which things went back in 1973. Back in 1973 in Chile, the case was made that all democratic channels had been exhausted. And it seems that we're following a very similar blueprint. Capriles had accepted the audit. Now he's backtracking. And
this is after the elections last month. The opposition leader Enrique Capriles saying, we don't agree with the result, we're going to challenge it.
Correct. And they challenged it. At first, he asked for an audit by the Electoral Commission. The Electoral Commission agreed. It wouldn't be a vote-by-vote recount because, Venezuela uses electronic voting systems. So they were going to audit. They are auditing 54% of all the votes. But now Capriles is saying that that might not be enough. And he has presented a challenge to the Supreme Court. asking the Supreme Court for, to annul the results.
But that option doesn't look likely. The Supreme Court made up of backers of Maduro, socialist backers of Maduro. What happens next then for the country if, in fact, the Supreme rejects what Capriles wants?
The situation is that even if the Supreme Court rejects the recount or the possibility of getting rid of the result, Capriles and the opposition can still say that the election was stolen and so that the government is illegitimate. And that's going to make things very, very difficult for Maduro. If you look at the press inside Venezuela, those sympathetic to Maduro are simply not talking about the issue, which is quite problematic. And they're going on about Maduro's street government, as he calls it. But the case is being made to cast a shadow throughout the entire Maduro administration.
Let's talk about NAFTA. Why not? It's the 20-year anniversary of the North American Free Trade Agreement. And at the moment, US President Barack Obama is in Mexico meeting his counterpart Enrique Peña Nieto. NAFTA has been one of those things that has been quite controversial in the US, but was enormously welcomed, wasn't it, in Mexico itself?
It was at the time. I mean, I still remember Salinas de Gortari coming on television and telling the Mexican people that they had joined the first world. Didn't happen, really. Things, as we know, didn't go that way afterwards. And precisely the deindustrialization that took place on the U.S.-Mexico border had something to do with the explosion of the drugs war and so on and so forth. So now we're at it again. The idea between Obama and Enrique Peña Nieto is to try and pour money into it, particularly in the border, so as to create new jobs and so on and so forth. The idea is to undermine the drugs war. It didn't work last time. Let's hope it works this time.
And moving away from the security issues, something from the economic issues, something that is getting a lot of traction, at least in the press, I think, is this decision by Mexican authorities to not allow American officials, intelligence officials, or law enforcement officials direct access to the Mexican counterparts. Is that something that is going to be a worry for Obama going forward and the American government?
Well, it is certainly something that is worrying members of the intelligence community in the United States. It isn't clear exactly why this is happening. Part of the reason seems to be political. Enrique Peña Nieto does not want to be seen, as some sort of U.S. puppet. I mean, he is the representative of the proud Partido Revolucionario Institucional, the nationalist party in Mexico. And yet, the thing is that the intelligence community in the U.S. Has been collaborating in the drugs war. And if the Colombian experience is anything to go by, that sort of collaboration goes beyond what most people know. So it is quite complicated from the point of view of the Americans, but it seems to be a political move welcomed from a Mexican perspective.
What's your overall take so far on Peña Nieto? Because he's, as you say, he's from the PRI, he's from the establishment. They ruled Mexico for 70-odd years. He's now brought them back into power. And yet he himself is, he's 46, he's young, he's charismatic. He's been, in his first 150-odd days, relatively popular within Mexico itself and has tried to begin to change the image of that country abroad. What's your take on his plan so far?
Well, I remember going to Mexico straight after the elections, and among the youth in particular, he was very unpopular. There was talk of, electoral results having been rigged and so on and so forth. He is a very telegenic person. He is very charismatic. That has helped. Mexicans are experts when it comes to image, and he's doing that job very well. It seems it is backing it up with realizations and needs. Let's hope that happens. But still, there is that peculiar sour, flavor in the mouth. Is the PRI again? We're at it again. I mean, the same one-party country, the same one-party that made Mexico turn Mexico into a one-party country is in government.
And Steve, you actually had the pleasure of interviewing Peña Nieto for this month's edition of Monocle magazine.
Yes, yes, indeed. So if you pick up the new May issue of Monocle, you'll see my interview with Peña Nieto. Yeah, interesting character, and he certainly talks a good game. But yeah, it is early days, 150-odd days, as we said. So a little bit, there's a long way to go, I think.
Early days indeed. But Oscar Guardiola-Rivera, many thanks, as always, for coming in to set the day's agenda for us.
Coming up, thanks to UNESCO, today is the day we celebrate and evaluate international press freedom. We'll unpick where we're at after this.
Istanbul is at the crossroads of Europe and Asia, and Monocle 24 is heading there for two very special shows. On Tuesday, May 7 and Wednesday, May 8, we'll be broadcasting live from the rooftop of the George Hotel in the company of some of Turkey's most influential leaders. Mark your calendars and tune into The Globalist on May 7 and May 8. That's at 8 a.m. Istanbul time, 6 a.m. here in London, and 1400 hours in Tokyo. The Globalist, live from Istanbul, in association with GE.
Welcome back to Midori House. Raising awareness of the importance of press freedom, violations of their independence, and the dangers journalists around the world face in the name of freedom of expression can only be a good thing.
Since 1993, the 3rd of May, that's today, has been proclaimed World Press Freedom Day by the UN General Assembly. It's held annually by UNESCO, ostensibly to encourage and develop initiatives in favour of press freedom and to assess the state of press freedom worldwide, if you're to believe the hype.
In a moment, we'll hear from Deputy Director of the International Press Institute, Anthony Mills, to assess how effective these institutional events are at securing press freedom. But before we do, we've compiled a series of reports from our correspondents and contributors in the field to shed some light on the health of the media around the world.
I'm Alex Duval-Smith. I cover West Africa for Monocle, but it's Mali where I live that currently habitually sets press freedom alarm bells ringing. To get an immediate flavour of how interim President Diomkunde Traore sees the role of the media, look no further than the start of last night's news on ORTM, the state broadcaster.
Mesdames et messieurs, bonsoir. Bienvenue.
What follows at the top of the evening news is a long list of presidential appointments. Which isn't to say that Mali doesn't have a vibrant media of its own, but it's confined to the radio waves and to dozens of private newspapers whose impact is limited because they're chiefly read, well, they would be, by people who can read. Journalists are hard up, and any organisation wishing to secure coverage of a press conference is well advised to reimburse reporters' taxi fares, a practice that leads to publicity-hungry companies and lobby groups trying to outdo each other's generosity. From time to time, things turn nasty, as they just have for Bukeri Dao, managing editor of Le Républicain. In March, his newspaper published a letter from Malian soldiers complaining about the conditions they endure on the front line. Dao was arrested by state security agents and held in a stinking cell without charge for 2 weeks. In a world where some journalists become mini-celebrities just because they're on the telly, and others get a buzz out of dissing celebrities, spare a thought for people like Bukeri Dao. They're the reason we need press freedom.
I'm Aisha Spears, Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. While freedom of the press has had a poor record in mainland China for decades now, press freedom in the Special Administrative Republic of Hong Kong has always been in better standing. However, over recent months, concerns have emerged over that changing. The city's ranking in the World Press Freedom Index dropped to its lowest position in 5 years at the start of 2013, mainly due to government plans to restrict public access to company information in Hong Kong. Mainland China's press situation is as bad as it's ever been, with both journalists and internet users in jail for having publicly criticized the government. While still considerably more liberal than Beijing, there is concern amongst Hong Kong press that if more restrictions go into place, the situation here could start to look a little more like that across the border.
I'm Samira Shackle and I'm based in Pakistan. It's sometimes a surprise to outsiders quite how free and vibrant the media in Pakistan actually is. The outgoing government has many faults, but it's done a lot to further freedom of expression. Newspapers have played a significant role in uncovering corruption and acting as a check on power over the last decade. Reporters critical of the government face less official interference today than they did before the return to civilian rule in 2008, but it's not an entirely positive picture. Last year, a UN report ranked Pakistan as the second most dangerous country in the world for journalists. Since 2000, more than 90 have been killed, mostly Pakistanis. Last year, I did some work with the national newspaper Dawn, and entering their offices in Karachi involved multiple metal detectors, bomb detectors, and bag searches, because the Taliban had directly threatened media groups over negative coverage. This high risk of death leads to a degree of self-censorship. This year's Human Rights Watch report said that a climate of fear impeded media coverage of the state security forces and militant groups. So while government corruption is freely reported on, the powerful military establishment remains largely untouched. Journalists know which areas they can push and which they can't. Foreign reporters are safer and therefore freer than local journalists, partly because we can afford to take more security measures, but most still proceed with a degree of caution on certain topics, like the ISI. However, we can be safe in the knowledge that the worst that's likely to happen to us is a swift exit from the country, while local journalists have nowhere to escape.
I'm Stephen Podson. I cover Chile for Monocle. Yesterday morning, I needed to interview Chile's acting economy minister. I parked my bicycle across the street from the presidential palace, handed my press ID to the palace guards, and in just a few minutes, I was mingling with ministers and with the president of Chile himself, Sebastian Piñera. And this is the great thing about reporting in Latin America. Informality works in our favor. Governments here are rarely organized enough to censor the press, even if they want to. And there's a general acceptance that pushy reporters will get the story, one way or another. But it's not all good news. This year, countries across the region fell on the annual Freedom House ranking of press freedom. Ecuador, in particular, keeps tumbling, this time for limiting reporting on the February presidential race. In Paraguay, President Federico Franco purged reporters from state media after taking power last year. In Brazil, Honduras, and Mexico, the problems are much more severe. Reporters are frequently killed for doing their job. Cuba, meanwhile, is one of the most repressive countries in the world, and Venezuela, which is freer than its reputation, has hounded opposition broadcast outlets close to extinction. The problem is that among the public, police, and politicians, there's no consensus that a free press is a good thing.
I'm Abdulrahman Hussein. I cover Egypt for Monocle. Undoubtedly, Egypt has undergone great transformation in the past 2 years. Much has changed, and yet there is still much that needs to change. Press freedom is an arena where the battle is still being fought, for the overthrow of a tyrant does not automatically translate into freedom from the shackles this tyrant and those who came before him as well as after him puts in place. First, there is violence to contend with. Journalists, photographers, and cameramen have come under attack while covering the tumultuous events underlining Egypt's transformation. Evading tear gas and bullets is only part of it, as security forces on an uncountable number of occasions have arrested, beaten, and detained members of the press. Then there are the archaic laws that have long been used to muzzle the press. Charges that former President Hosni Mubarak often used to silence media dissent, such as the offenses of insulting the head of state or threatening the security of the state, have often been used to put members of the press behind bars. And in post-revolutionary Egypt, this same mechanism has been used by the new Muslim Brotherhood President Mohamed Morsi and his administration. In fact, the number of charges filed against the press have increased since Morsi assumed the presidency.
And that was Abdulrahman Hussein in Cairo. Before that, you heard Steve Bodson, Samira Shackle, Aisha Spears and Alex Duval-Smith. We're joined now on the line by Anthony Mills, Deputy Director of the International Press Institute. Anthony, thank you very much for joining us today. Now, we know that journalism can be very dangerous in war zones. We know that it can be very dangerous in a dictatorship. But a number of those themes that came out there seem to be suggesting that even in democracies, journalism is under attack.
Absolutely. There are various kinds of threat to journalists. And of course, in many respects, the most high profile is the threat that they face in conflict zones. And Syria is right now, according to our Death Watch, the most dangerous country on earth for journalists. But even in other countries, and countries that are nominal democracies or where there's a relative degree of democracy, journalists face threats through, for example, criminal defamation lawsuits, where criminal defamation laws are abused to stifle any form of criticism, and where the result is either that the journalist goes to jail, or that they and or their newspaper or their media outlet end up paying a massively disproportionate fine. Then there's various kinds of harassment through the security services, through hired thugs, and the list goes on. And this, of course, all happens in countries where, as I say, there is a degree of democracy. And of course, the International Press Institute is based in Vienna, in the heart of Europe. And even here, there are threats to press freedom. Take a look at the aftermath of the Leveson inquiry in the UK, where for the first time in hundreds of years, there's talk about statutory regulation of the press. Take Hungary, where a new media constitution has narrowed the space for independent reporting. Take Greece, where journalists are being attacked by security services, by the police for covering demonstrations, and so on and so forth.
Worrying trend from the latest Press Freedom Index from 2013 showed that regional powers around the world, it was them who were really making the rankings fall. Brazil lost 9 spots on the list, Russia was down 6, India down 9, South Africa down 10. That is a very worrying trend.
It is a very worrying trend, and ironically, it coincides with, in many respects, a sort of an unprecedented international drive to promote the safety of journalists. We've had the UN-wide action plan, UNESCO-led action plan on the safety of journalists and the issue of impunity, which is now a UN agency-wide dynamic that is beginning to be implemented. We've had the resolution that was passed at the UN Human Rights Council last autumn that was also a landmark achievement. And yet, at the same, and this all in conjunction with really active input by civil society and so on, and yet at the same time, as you point out, we have regional powerhouses, a number of them democracies that should be at the forefront of this battle to protect journalists and to ensure that they're able to report critically without being threatened and without being killed and so on. And the opposite is happening. So what we're seeing is there's still an enormous chasm between acceptance in principle by countries, including regional powers, of the principle of press freedom and of resolutions and various action plans and so on, and reality on the ground, implementation on the ground. And it's worth bearing in mind that these countries have a responsibility to protect journalists and to bring their aggressors to justice.
Anthony Mills of the International Press Institute will have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. We're in Jakarta next. You're listening to Midori House. It's just turned 14:28 in Jakarta, 8:28 here in London. Let's head now to Indonesia.
Ben Bland is our man on the ground there, and he's on the line. Welcome to the show, Ben. You've chosen a couple stories making headlines out there in Indonesia, but let's start with this change, this cut in fuel subsidies.
Well, yeah, this is a proposed cut in the fuel subsidy here, which has been a long time coming. Indonesia spends at the moment around $20 billion a year to keep petrol cheap, which obviously makes motorists and motorbike users on Indonesia's traffic-clogged streets happy. But unfortunately, it's weighing down the budget and adding to concerns about macroeconomic stability in what has been one of Asia's hottest emerging markets. Now, after sort of a couple of years of debate about what to do and pressure to cut the subsidy, the president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, this week has said that he is planning to push ahead with a cut to the subsidy, but only once he's convinced the parliament here to agree to measures to help the poor people who are going to be affected, he says, if they increase the price of fuel.
Ben,
so, basically, he passed.
On this point, it's interesting, you know, from a Western perspective, often, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, these subsidies are, you know, they're uneconomic, they don't really make sense. And yet, you know, for a lot of people in Indonesia, this will be one of the very few concrete things that the government actually does for them, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I think you see similar issues in countries like Nigeria, Venezuela, etc., where although it is clearly a very inefficient way to parcel out the state budget, the fact is in a country where education and health services are very poor, public transport is non-existent. Indeed, as you say, cheap petrol is one of the few concrete benefits that people from, you know, those at the bottom to the middle class can actually get back from the government, which is why it's such a hot political issue. And that even though, you know, the rational economic Western argument is to cut subsidies, there's a lot of resistance politically to doing so.
So what kind of impact are these kind of policies having on Indonesia in terms of whether or not people should invest in it? I understand Standard & Poor's saying that they're going to upgrade the Philippines, but not necessarily so with Indonesia.
Yes. Yesterday, Standard & Poor's, which is one of the big rating agencies, upgraded the Philippines to investment grade, which means it's the top ranking. It means it's cheap for the government to issue debt overseas. But they said they weren't going to do the same in Indonesia, because while they were convinced that the Philippines was moving in the right direction in terms of managing its budget and ensuring macroeconomic stability, they were concerned that Indonesia was moving the other way. One of the key issues there is the fuel subsidy. There's also been a spate of nationalistic economic policies, and this all seems tied into the upcoming presidential and parliamentary elections next year, when President Yudhoyono is going to step down after reaching his two-term limit. So while Indonesia has been the darling of investors in Southeast Asia, it seems that baton is now passing to Philippines, which may ultimately say as much about the fickleness of international investors as it does about Indonesia's reform relative to the Philippines.
Quite. Ben Bland, our man in Indonesia, thank you very much indeed for bringing us up to speed.
In the next half hour of the program, our Alexandra de Kramer will run us through this morning's Turkish front pages, and we'll talk about everyone's favorite car, the Volkswagen Beetle.
All that plus some music. Phil, have you chosen what the music is yet? Do you know what you want?
It's a surprise.
A surprise. Excellent. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the headlines.
Officials in Bangladesh now say that more than 500 people died in the collapse of a factory building close to the capital, Dhaka. Another 20 bodies are pulled overnight from the rubble. A large number of people are still missing, and a total of 9 people have now been arrested in connection with the collapse of the building. The United States could change its policy on arming rebel fighters in Syria. It's a year since President Obama rejected a proposal to supply weapons to groups opposing President Assad, but he's now said that all options are under review. The special prosecutor in the killing of the former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto has been shot and killed outside his home in Islamabad. Chaudhry Zulfikar Ali was ambushed as he headed to a court in the city less than 2 weeks before Pakistan's elections. An Indian man who was killed in a Pakistani prison is due to be buried today. There are large crowds expected at the funeral of Sarabjit Singh near the city of Amritsar. He was sentenced to death by Pakistan for spying more than 20 years ago, though he died after being attacked with bricks by other prisoners at the jail in Lahore. And more than 900 people have been arrested in China after an investigation into the sale of fake meat. Officials say in one case foxes and rats were being passed off as mutton. So far, more than 20,000 tons of suspect meat has been seized. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Steve Bloomfield. Now, the first time you see one speeding down your road, you'll never forget it. The distinctive shape, its headlamp eyes staring back at you, the sweet but somewhat sexy nature of it all. Confused?
Yes.
Well, I'm talking about that iconic car, the Volkswagen Beetle.
He is indeed. It's known simply to many as the people's car. Although from its beginnings during Nazi Germany to its rebirth in the 90s, the VW Beetle has had a long and, let's face it, sometimes bumpy road. It's a story that's been turned into a new book by Bernhard Reiger called The People's Car, A Global History of the Volkswagen Beetle. And Bernhard joins us now in the studio. Bernhard, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, and thanks for having me.
It's quite all right. It's an astonishing story in the fact that this was a car that was commissioned by Adolf Hitler. And yet somehow it's managed to get over that sort of rather curious past and become a real icon in its own right.
Yes, and it's a story with really many twists and turns, and I think it has profited from the fact that the Third Reich never really produced the car, even though the Nazi regime, which was really a dictatorship, very repressive. But that's not the whole story of Nazi Germany. It also wanted to offer its citizens, especially the so-called Aryans, some benefits. And one of the most spectacular initiatives was basically the leisure organization Strength Through Joy, which turned into the biggest travel agency. And its most prestigious project was building a car for all, which had not been tried in interwar Europe at all.
And you give a very interesting figure in your book. You say there was only 81,000 passenger cars in Germany in the early 1920s, and that's compared with 15.4 million in the United States. So obviously the Germans, I guess, a bit envious, weren't they?
They were extremely envious, and I mean, what that figure shows is the dramatic difference in terms of wealth that had developed across the Atlantic on both sides. The First World War really impoverished Germany, and it was also compared with other European nations such as Great Britain or France, I mean, way behind in terms of car ownership. That shows you the ambition of this plan that the Nazis launched in the 30s.
Now, as you say, it was a somewhat sort of a rocky ride for the Beetle. Talk us through what happened in the post-war years, in the 50s and 60s. Why did it not necessarily take off as well as it has in the last sort of 10 or 20 years?
The factory that was built by the Third Reich ended up in the British sector, and the British really were the first ones to produce the car because they needed cars to run the occupation zone. And then they handed over the management to the Germans. And then basically this long stretch of economic growth in the 50s and 60s propelled Germany, West Germany, into an affluent society. And then people started buying this car en masse and became the symbol, I mean, the biggest symbol, really, of post-war Germany. And people really loved the car because it showed them that things were moving forward after this complete collapse.
But in the book, you also describe quite the startling similarities between the car and Adolf Hitler, the man himself.
To an extent, Hitler's brainchild, because, I mean, one psychological trait that Hitler had was that he ignored reality. And, I mean, this was such an ambitious scheme in the Third Reich, and it was completely, I mean, the German car industry did not want to develop this car. In fact, it was developed outside of the German car industry by an independent engineering agency run by Ferdinand Porsche, this famous also designer. And Hitler ignored all warnings that this would not work because the Germans just simply could not afford it. And so in that sense, it has that similarity to Hitler in that it is a product of a complete lack of economic realism.
When you look at the design of the car, it's one of those, it's got the sort of shape that you recognise in a silhouette in a way that you wouldn't with pretty much any other car. Why do you think it's been able to succeed with that design for so long? Because, lots of other cars, they change, they become a little bit smoother here, maybe there'll be a hatchback version, with a Beetle. A Beetle now looks pretty much the same as a Beetle, 60, 70 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's as iconic in shape as the Coke bottle by now. And the reason it stayed that way for such a long time and into the present is because over time it found always new markets. Really, production only stopped in 2003 in Mexico. And the shape is sort of like a slightly streamlined shape that comes out of the 30s. It has sort of Art Deco influences in it. It was actually tested in wind channels to make it sort of like streamliney. But it's also, it takes up this modernist design element of the 30s. And as long as there was always demand in some parts of the world, you didn't really have to change that kind of shape. You could really run with it.
And it is amazing seeing this car in so many numbers, especially in the United States. It really had that rebirth, in the mid to late 90s. Everyone was driving one. Everyone wanted one. Everyone wanted to have, you know, that little flower in the front of their dashboard and the built-in, the daisy. Yeah. So what is it about this car that after all these years, you know, it's still just as fashionable as it was during the period of Hitler?
Well, this is in particular the case in the case with the United States, where the minute it arrived, which was really in the 50s, it was seen as cute and unconventional. And that was because it was the complete opposite of the shapes that dominated American car culture in the 50s. I mean, you have to think of the Cadillac with its tail fin and its huge engines, its air conditioners, and God knows what pastel colors, multicolor schemes. So, I mean, really quite Baroque cars. And next to this, in terms of the shape and the size, it just stuck out like a duck in a tiger's cage. People bought it en masse, especially middle-class Americans. And in the 90s, VW could bring it back because there were, first of all, a lot of Americans that had one in the 60s that remembered it and wanted it back to sort of basically get an object from their youth back. And then a lot of young and affluent Americans that were fashionable. And they wanted a retro object. That was the late 90s was the time when retro really took off. And VW got these two target groups with this car.
Bernhard, be honest. How many Beetles do you own yourself?
None. I don't even have a car. I live in London. I use public transport.
Have you ever had a Beetle?
I have not had a Beetle, but I have memories of a Beetle, of course, from my family. And my parents drove to Sicily in 1960 with a grey Beetle that sort of they very much loved and were very sad when they had to let it go.
Okay, well, that's fair enough then. Fair enough. Bernhard Rieger, author of The People's Car, who doesn't actually drive a people's car because he takes the people's public transport.
Indeed.
Thank you very much for your time.
You are listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a culinary roundtable. A chef and three good food writers give their verdict on the 50 best restaurants of the year.
House Vision in Tokyo is an exhibition that combines the wisdom of Japan's best creative thinkers with state-of-the-art technology. Curated by the visionary designer Kenyahara, the mission was to explore new and unconventional ways of urban living.
Japan's post-war growth spurt might have brought wealth, but one of the great ironies is that despite rising incomes, most Japanese live in homes that are cramped and uniformly bland. For all the expert craftsmanship that goes into building homes here, rarely do they last more than a generation.
House Vision, a future perfect film from Tokyo on Monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House. Steve, have you ever had a Beetle?
Did
you
ever? No, I had a Volkswagen Polo. When I was younger,
so you still kept it in the Volkswagen family.
I had a V-dub, but not the Beetle. No, I did have a very old Land Cruiser once, which was sort of
very
iconic
English
in
things.
Its own way.
Yeah.
But
no, I'm like Bernhard. I take the people's transport.
Do you? Yes. Well, so do I now.
Yeah. Moving on, this week on the menu, Marcus Hippie speaks to three food writers, Bruce Palling, Alexandra Forbes, and Andrea Pretini, about the one list every chef wants to be on: this year's World 50 Best Restaurants list. At number three, Osteria Francesca Canna, a three Michelin star restaurant based in Modena, Italy. Chef patron Massimo Boutreau also joins Marcus in the studio for this week's show, and here's a sneak preview of their chat.
How much influence does a ranking list like this have? How
it
do
is.
You feel about it?
Yes, a lot of influence, especially in the young gourmet. They're like traveling all over the world. They come at the restaurant. They don't even open the menu. They look at you and they say, okay, cook whatever you want, you know, serve us whatever you want. We want to live the experience. We want to be part of the Osteria Francescana for one night. It's like going to the theater and enjoy the music and the opera.
And how carefully do you follow what the other, say, other top 10 restaurants are doing? Do you need to follow that?
Being the 50 is great. Being in the top 10 is like, wow, that was really, really important because the focus is there. And being the top five for many years is like the most beautiful things ever. You know, it's you have a responsibility because everyone is looking at you. But at one point, when you feel that and you have inside and you do and you arrive there with such a natural, doing everything so naturally, you do it, you know.
And, well, the latest ventures in your restaurant, I already heard that there is a new tasting menu.
Yeah, you're very well informed.
You want to tell about that?
Yeah, it came out from an idea, not the feeling I had, like... about my country and how reflecting how difficult is the situation, not just economically, but it's like a real crisis of identity. And when I hear an Italian speaking bad, talking bad about their country, I feel bad. So as my father-in-law was always telling me about the famous phrase by JFK, just ask yourself what you can do for your country, not what the country can do for you. And I thought to create a menu called Come to Italy with Me. Just is the way to rediscover, to refall in love for Italy again, for the second time, from the breathing wind of Pantelleria to the beauty of Sicily or the charming Gulf of Naples coming up to Adriatic Sea and arriving in under the porch of Modena or Bologna or the Emilia or the Dolomites, rediscover the Dolomites on the beauty of the country of Tuscany. So through the flavors, through the palate. So you close your eyes, you hear the stories and you eat edible ideas.
That's such a beautiful idea that it's not just that we're not just talking about a plate of food, it's actually a social gesture, a message.
Yeah, that's another thing that is, to me, really matters a lot. Because as soon as we develop this idea of create plates, they're like attic, put the attic close to the static part of the dishes, the evolution of this became... create and cook recipes, they can be a social gesture to help the other. Because if you work in a territory, in a territory like Emilia, in a place where the Parmigiano Reggiano, balsamic vinegar, the ham, mortadella, all the different mythic ingredients, you have to get deep into the relation between you and the fishermen, the cheesemaker, the farmers, the people that are like giving these incredible ingredients. And and so like that is like a way to share the beauty and the joy of having results. And when the joy is shared, is much more deep and beautiful.
It sounds like you have a very special role in the local community.
Yeah, I have a big responsibility, you know, because all the spots are on me and Osteria Francescana. But no one talks about the beautiful team I have, you know, because I am one. Lara is another, but we have 28 guys that are working and serving 28 people. And so they're doing incredible things. And there are all these producers, these people that are working for us, and they listen to what we say. And so if you do the right thing and you create this kind of feeling around you, everything is going to be better. Everything is going to be so much beautiful, you know, because it's about that. It's about that life. It's like it's about sharing.
I think everything's always better with a nice plate of food.
It does help, doesn't it? Yeah.
I'm starving as well. That was Massimo Bottura of Osteria Francescana in Modena, Italy, speaking to Marcus Hippy for this week's edition of The Menu, which you can, of course, catch tonight at 1900 hours London time.
Now, a review of the Turkish press is coming up in just a moment. But first, to take us there, one of the great Turkish bands, pioneers of Turkish funk rock over the past 40 years. This is Morla with Çırık.
Thank you.
And that was Steve Bloomfield's favorite song. Did you just admit that to me during the break?
Yeah, yeah. No, I really like that.
That was Çığırık by the Turkish funk folk psych legends Muğlar. You're listening to Midori House with me, Philhan, and Steve Bloomfield. It's now time to stick with Turkey because we have our very own young Turk in the studio with us, Alexandra de Kramer, with the Turkish front pages, which resemble comic book covers, we were saying. They're just so colourful, aren't they?
Yeah, aren't they?
They make me dizzy. I mean, look at Hürriyet. Look at it. I mean, it's like, how can you even... Are there, like... 15
stories.
At least.
Pictures and stories and...
cartoons.
Yeah.
And commercials.
Let's not talk about Justin Bieber. We might come
to
Bieber
later.
Yeah, yeah. But let's start with a far more sort of sedate cover, Radical. Half the front page is taken up with a picture of Prime Minister Erdogan there.
With a finger up.
With his finger up, making a point...
Typical Turkish gesture.
And so, what's the point he's trying to make?
So basically the fourth package to change the Turkish constitution has been ratified by Abdullah Gül, our president. And basically he gave a press conference saying that he wants a presidency system or he wants to change the constitution, which hasn't been updated since the 20s.
So at the moment there's a president, but the real power is with the prime minister, with Erdogan. And
exactly.
The ruling AKP want to change that to have a more of a centralized presidential system.
Exactly, like the American one, because the president doesn't have the sole power and he can't veto. He can veto, but he doesn't have that enough power like the American president. And the elections are coming up in 2014, so next year. And obviously they have been in the office for two terms, so they need to reshuffle. And this is the only way they're going to be in power.
So rather than standing down and allowing other contenders to take a place, they're trying to change the constitution to shift roles again.
Actually, Erdogan's statement was this, for the opposition leaders, basically, that they do not have... The opposition has no name to win the presidency, so that's why they're scared. Like, he doesn't even believe that he has competition, which to some extent is true. Like, the opposition parties haven't been that strong or didn't have that many strong candidates. Like, Kılıçdaroğlu, who is the president of the CHP party, he actually forgot to sign himself for a ballot. So he wasn't registered to vote on a ballot. So that obviously...
That's not going to help.
Yeah, exactly, you know.
What's how are the Turkish press covering this? Are they welcoming these kind of changes or are they shouting foul?
Not the front covers. Some columnists are obviously against this and they're shouting foul. Yeah, we shouldn't be doing this. But I think the constitution needs to be updated. I don't know whether the presidency system is going to be what Turkey needs, but it's obviously streaming away from democracy, which we don't want because... We're the Middle Eastern democracy model. So
let's have a little look at Hürriyet, which we mentioned before. Now, of these jumble of front page stories there are here, what is it that's caught your eye on the front of Hürriyet?
I think the main story, there are two main stories that caught my eye. First of all, on the left-hand side. So, you know, 1st of May is Labor Day in Turkey, which became a bank holiday in 2010. It was banned. Because we had the Taksim masquerade in the 70s when leftist, rightist and the coup and everything. So
and there were huge protests in Istanbul.
Yeah,
just 2 days ago
actually,
as well.
Our SM Sam went before our show and the streets were empty because where we're streaming the show is
because of course we're going to be in Istanbul doing the Globus next week. So yeah, so we've sent out a team to do a little recce ahead of it. And yes, yeah, so Sam Impey, one of our studio managers, was there. Yeah, empty streets
exactly.
on May the 1st.
The smell of tear gas in the air, she said.
So basically, what happened is this girl who's 17, who was in the protests or in the march, got hit by a tear gas bomb, and she's in a coma at the moment. She's 17, and They told the press basically was saying that she's a militant, like the headline says she's a militant. And obviously the father spoke up being like, how can you accuse a 17-year-old of being a militant or a terrorist? She was just like with her friends attending a protest or a peace walk. So it's still a big deal in Turkey.
It is indeed. And it's on the front of Hürriyet and then also on the left-hand side of Radical as well.
And another story here about the landmines that are scattered around the country's eastern and southeastern provinces. Quite an astounding number, around 1 million of them.
Yeah. So because as you know, because of the PKK on the eastern border, there were a lot of mines scattered around in the area. And the Turkish government is still working to remove them. But by 1st of March 2014, we need to get rid of all of them because they signed them. The Ottawa Treaty in 2003. But this is kind of a prelude to that being like, we are still not ready. Two of our soldiers died because of a mine yesterday in Uder. And we should stop this happening because it's a recurring event.
Now, briefly, while we've got you here, as we were saying, we're going to be in Istanbul live next week with the Globalist on Tuesday and Wednesday. I think even actually part of Monday's show is going to be coming from there as well. Alex, you're going to be there. In fact, Phil, you're going to be there as well, aren't you?
I will be there indeed.
Alex, give us a little bit of a highlight of what we can expect next week.
So we have really big names. Temay Kotil, the CEO of Turkish Airlines, is joining us.
Fantastic.
We're having a round table. So the curator of Salt's Gallery, Vasif Kurtan, will be joining us to talk about the up-and-coming art scene of Istanbul.
It's a big push for Istanbul, but to really reassert itself as kind of a cultural capital, I think, in the world. So that's one of the interesting kind of conversations we'll have. We'll also be speaking, while we talk about kind of turning yourself into a world city, the head of Istanbul's 2020 Olympic bid, Hasan Arat. That, of course, is that decision will be made in September, I believe, and they're competing against Tokyo and Madrid.
And more importantly, Alex, are you going to show Phil where to go out in Istanbul?
Are you ready, Phil?
I'm excited. Yeah. I'm excited. It's looking like amazing weather there by the Bosphorus.
It's 26.
Yeah. Okay. I don't want to hear that. So next week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday's Globalist, all coming from Istanbul. Phil will be producing, Alex will be researching, and Tyler and Andrew, I believe, will be...
Two very special guests, yeah.
We'll be hosting. Alexandra de Kramer, thank you very much indeed for that review of the Turkish papers and that look ahead to next week. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Alid John, our researchers Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Annabelle Bly, our studio manager Chris Fitcher. Up next after the news is this week's edition of Section D, hosted by Hugo McDonald. That's it for Midori House today and indeed this week. We'll be back on Monday, of course, here in London, even if the Globalist is in Turkey, for more news, analysis and special guests. But for now, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And I'm Phil Hahn.
Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.